Governor Holcomb vetoes the trans sports bill. Senator Braun has opinions about the Supreme Court. Plus, Holcomb signs the gun bill and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 25th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb vetoed a bill that would ban transgender girls from girls' school sports. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports, the debate about rules for transgender athletes is far from over.
Holcomb's veto letter echoed many of the concerns laid out by the bill's opponents during this year's legislative session, and many of them applauded the governor's decision. But lawmakers still have the authority to overturn Holcomb's veto. Katie Blair, Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the ACLU of Indiana, says that's why it's critical people continue to reach out to their representatives.
Lawmakers can certainly bring this bill back up. They can bring it back up over the summer months if they want to come in and override the governor's veto.
Several state and federal Republican lawmakers have called for the General Assembly to override the veto. House Speaker Todd Houston said in a statement Tuesday the House will do so on May 24th.
Are you surprised Holcomb vetoed the trans sports bill? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, are you surprised?
I don't know anyone, well, certainly we know some, but for me it's like, how could you watch all of the trans children, their families, their priests, their pastors, and their rabbis come to the State House en masse over and over again and, you know, have to ask for their human dignity, which is a sad thing that they had to do, but to really show that they were part of their community. As Hoosiers, we value sports because that we value what it teaches our children for leadership. We value that it teaches equality and it teaches hard work. So to say that that's for some kids and not others, and to see all of the testimony and how the trans community really organized around this issue, I don't know how you could not veto it. And I'm really sad to see that it could be coming back in a special session.
Yeah, I would expect it to be pretty easily overridden, particularly because Indiana has a relatively weak veto. But are you surprised the governor vetoed this bill?
I am surprised, actually, and in part for everything that Elise just said. She's right. I worked on Freedom Indiana and the civil rights expansion effort several years ago as attitudes were changing in Indiana on this issue as a precursor to the legalization of gay marriage. I think most people, the reason this polls so well on a bipartisan basis, by the way, is because I don't think people look at this, and I think people generally do believe, should transgendered people be able to get married? Of course. Should they be able to adopt or have a child? Absolutely. Should they be fired from work? Of course not. Should their kids be able to arm wrestle competitively in high school? Wait a minute. What? Like, it's one of those where people are like, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense to me. And one thing we've seen this week at the college level, we saw the NCAA come into this legislative session and say, take us out of this legislation. We have got this figured out. Nobody thinks the NCAA's got this figured out after the last couple weeks of the national debate on this. This issue's coming to a head nationally. So there's space. There has to be space for the transgender community to participate in everything that all kids alike should be able to participate in. Certainly, are we close to having that figured out for your average person? Absolutely not. And that's why you saw the politics are what they are on this issue.
John, policy aside, I want to talk about the politics of it for the governor. Did this hurt him, and if so, how much?
It doesn't help him, I think. There were a lot of Republicans, and we've talked about this throughout the session, who think he's, heaven forbid, a rhino, you know, Republican in name only, that he has taken positions throughout the session on various issues, whether it had to do with emergency powers and COVID or his initial stance on a tax cut. Now, granted, that changed a little bit over time. But there were various areas where the most conservative wing of the party thought, is he really with us? So it probably, from that standpoint,
They already didn't think he was with them.
Didn't think he was with them. I mean, this is a surprise to me. In fact, I think I predicted on the show a few weeks ago that he would sign this. And in fact, I was basing that largely on the fact that he had indicated he would. Yeah, I mean, there was sort of tacit endorsement. He indicated he would.
Yeah, he certainly hadn't expressed any actual concerns about it.
So it, you know, not much surprises me anymore. That surprised me when I saw that.
Well, you even had, like, the IHSAA by the end of the session was neutral because the dispute resolution, like that arbitration process that he cited as the second reason he vetoed it, that was the IHSAA's idea. That was, like, their language that was put into the bill. So it was it was weird how the positions came together in the end. And I think we also, when we talked about it a couple weeks ago, it was also how was this issue positioned against permitless carry and like other stuff that he had to do.
I was wrong on that one too. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let me just say this is the odd thing here. This is going to be litigated, obviously. I mean, no matter what happens,
assuming the veto gets overridden.
Yeah, yes. And I think that's where the analysis will come down to something perhaps as simple on this bill as whether it measures up or withstands a scrutiny of the 14th Amendment, because this only applies, of course, to transgender girls and the sports that they can compete in. It's not the opposite.
Right.
I'm no lawyer, but that seems to me a potential flaw for a court who simply on a wants to look at this from a constitutional basis, not minding how do you deal with these nuanced issues.
Imagine that, Indiana passing something that ends up having to be relitigated in the courts.
They never do that. No major abortion bill so far this year, so ACLU's got to make its money some way from the state.
That'll be later.
But this, talking about the political fallout for the governor, this veto attracted more attention than a typical veto does in this state.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you've got national stories going on about it, and then I think 2 days later, the Utah governor, a Republican Utah governor, did the same thing. So,
although the Utah governor was much more direct about what he thought about the bill, as opposed to looking at sort of the technical issues with the bill.
Right. But, I mean, look, I think it's going to hurt the governor. I was chatting with a House member, a Republican House member, who was out knocking on doors this week. He said every single person wanted to talk about that bill. That's all they wanted to talk about.
All right, time now for viewer feedback.
Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, will Governor Eric Holcomb's veto of a bill banning transgender girls from girls' sports hurt him politically? A yes or B no. Last week we asked you about daylight saving time. Should the U.S. make it permanent? Just 33% of you say make daylight saving time permanent. 13% say the clocks should continue to change. I don't know who you are, but I don't agree with you. 54% of you, though, think we should make standard time permanent. Count me among that 54%. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana Republican U.S. Senator Mike Braun this week said the U.S. Supreme Court was wrong to legalize interracial marriage nationwide. Yep, that's what he said. Braun's comments came as he discussed what he's looking for as he evaluates Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. As the Senate Judiciary Committee holds confirmation hearings for Judge Jackson, Senator Braun says she seems well qualified, and the GOP lawmaker says as he evaluates her record, he wants a justice who won't be an activist.
Stick with interpreting the law. Don't legislate from the bench.
Braun says examples of judicial activism include the landmark decision legalizing abortion. He says the Supreme Court shouldn't homogenize issues nationwide, instead leaving them up to individual states to decide, which extends, when asked, to include interracial marriage.
If you're not wanting the Supreme Court to weigh in on issues like that, you're not going to be able to have your cake and eat it, too. I think that's hypocritical.
In a follow-up statement, Braun claimed he misunderstood the line of questioning. The Republican says the Constitution unquestionably bans racial discrimination and that he condemns racism at all levels. But in the news conference, Braun was asked multiple times specifically about interracial marriage.
So you would be okay with the Supreme Court leaving the question of interracial marriage to the states?
Yes.
Mike O'Brien, why should anyone buy the misunderstanding claim? I mean, that was as direct as you can get.
Because it's 2022, and it'd be absurd to think that literally anyone thinks that interracial marriage shouldn't be legal.
And yet?
I was born in the 20th century. I spent 0 minutes thinking about this, whether or not it should be illegal. So, one, I think we saw this with critical race theory during the session. We're seeing it now with the Supreme Court debate over states' rights and parents' rights. And these guys, we saw state senators, we saw Braun in this situation, they get so spun up on not being hypocritical. That's why we were defending Nazism during the session, right? Because, like, okay, well, you can't teach bias on anything. What about Nazism? Yeah, no bias on anything. Okay, wait a minute. There are certain things that are moral absolutes that, like, we believe that aren't state rights questions. They are United States questions, right? That they are things that we all should believe or have decided are the moral authority of the country. And we shouldn't have to go state by state by state to decide whether interracial marriage should be legal or whether slavery should have been legal or gay marriage or, you know, name your issue. There are things that transcend what we should decide in state legislatures that are what make us a country. But I think these guys in these debates, they get so locked in on states' rights or no bias being taught in classrooms that they just can't get out of the lane without thinking that they're going to look hypocritical and in the process wind up defending things or positions that are completely indefensible.
Well, and, you know, and they do harm. There are interracial couples across our state, interracial Hoosier couples that, you know, you can't just say this thing and not do harm to people. It's not like this exists in this political vacuum and people don't hear it and their kids don't hear it. And that harm isn't traumatic to some people. And I don't know, in this case, maybe when people show you who they are, you should believe them, like Maya Angelou says. And also in this case, I think he fell into the trap of when you're explaining, you're losing. And his explanation did not help him at all.
But I can't believe looking at this that people go, what a bigot. That, what he was doing in that state, he was trying to be an absolutist in states' rights in the context of a fight over who, whether or not this nominee for the Supreme Court should be nominated. And that results, and that again, it's just like Scott Baldwin.
I mean,
Scott Baldwin isn't pro Nazi.
It still lacks
it
integrity when you're just doing things for a political
win. And it is damaging.
It's damaging, it lacks integrity, and Hoosiers, interracial couples in our state, and all Hoosiers deserve better, and he's embarrassed us.
There's some thought that he thought he was talking about gay marriage.
Correct.
Does that make it better?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the only the way you can understand the misunderstanding is it clearly we were talking about marriage, and so I think he maybe thought gay marriage, and maybe he clearly draws a line between race and, you know, sexual orientation in that sense. But either way, I mean, shouldn't that still be following the same logic line? Yeah, I mean, he just got himself in a whole heap of trouble on this one.
He's not up for election for a couple of years. So there's outrage, certainly. But will there be any real fallout for Mike Braun, practically speaking?
Well, he's fortunate in that there's not an election coming up that he's participating in.
Who knows what we'll say between now and then.
Right. I mean,
he can be out of the headlines tomorrow.
As I have often said, though, just because there's a distance between now and that next time he's his name's on the ballot, doesn't mean that opponents can't find ways to paint him with that brush and to, you know, yes, the electorate has a short attention span and its memory is limited. And on its own, this would be gone next week out of their memories. But if a skillful, well-funded opponent can find ways to bring this up and create this theme that here's somebody who is still fighting the Civil War, and still questioning whether the federal government has the supremacy clause, you know, and can find a way to paint him into that corner and can fund, you know, spots that back that up, well, then it becomes a potentially potent weapon in the hands of opponents.
You could even move beyond interracial marriage.
Well, you could
say, okay, maybe he didn't mean that, but does he think that about gay marriage? Does he think that about your access to birth control? Does he think that about
that interracial marriage should be permitted, but it should be a state rights issue?
Absurd.
I appreciate that, but the part of this is a reaction to, just like CRT was a reaction to bias in classrooms, this is what he said here is a reaction to activist judiciaries, you know, chipping away at states' rights. Now, is this the example you go make?
Of course not. Not something you put out there as a sitting state senator.
And he provided some lovely actual video of himself saying it.
Yeah. You talk about hypocrisy or moral consistency, and the problem with that is then you start to say...
Totally. That's what I'm trying to say.
Then you start to say, though, okay, what about these other constitutional protections? The right to carry firearms.
Well, that's
the things you like.
Well, you could argue, but you could argue, well, by God, yes, but you could argue that that equal rights are enshrined in the Constitution as well.
Yeah, or privacy.
And the flip side of that, if you want to talk about something like flag burning, I'm sure that opponents of flag burning would say, well, this isn't something that should be handled on a piecemeal basis where crazy California can let you burn a flag, but Arkansas won't let you or Alabama won't. They'd say, let's do this at the national level. So there's a real fundamental inconsistency in this.
It can't be case by case. It's got to be case by case.
But it always is. It always is.
All right. Hoosiers will no longer have to get a permit. Speaking of guns, hey, Hoosiers will no longer have to get a permit to carry a handgun in public starting July 1st. That's after Governor Eric Holcomb signed the so-called permitless carry bill into law this week. In a statement, Holcomb defended his decision by expressing his full support for the Second Amendment and noting that 23 other states have some version of a permitless carry policy. Holcomb also says people currently barred from carrying in public will still be barred from carrying in public after the law takes effect. Yet the state police testified that thousands of people each year had their carry permit applications denied. Opponents of the bill question how those people will know they're not allowed to carry in public once the permits are no longer required. In a statement accompanying Holcomb's, State Police Superintendent Doug Carter pledged to work towards solutions enacting the law and make necessary changes to firearms enforcement. A few weeks ago, Carter sharply criticized Republicans pushing the law, telling them their support of permitless carry meant they don't support law enforcement. There was no mention of that sentiment in Carter's latest statement. The question. Nikki Kelly, are you? I asked about the surprise of the veto. Are you surprised he signed this bill?
Less surprised than I was with the veto. I thought he might let it become law without a signature or sign it. I didn't think he would veto it. I think that would be impossible for him to come back if he vetoed a Second Amendment bill. So in that sense, no. But they came on the same day, so altogether it was a surprise in that manner. But I think he did what he needed to do if he's going to try to run in for something else such as the U.S. Senate.
I want to talk about Doug Carter. He is an employee of the state of Indiana and an appointee of Governor Eric Holcomb. So I don't think the statement sent out by the governor's office was going to include Doug Carter slamming his boss. But if you're Doug Carter, how do you continue to work as the state police superintendent after saying what you said and then having your boss sign that bill into law?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when he's vested, when his pension is vested. I don't know the particulars of his HR status. And all kidding aside, maybe that does come into it. Because as outspoken as he was on this issue, and to be standing in the back of the chamber in uniform when this was being voted upon, doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room. Now, he says, of course, that he is going to do his best to find ways to adjust practice to fit this new policy. But it's tough. It puts him in a tough position. And I was 100% wrong on this. I was the one person, I think, at this table who thought the governor would veto it. I still think there's a danger to him now every time, and hope this doesn't happen. Let's all hope it doesn't happen. But if a police officer, makes a stop and somebody who shouldn't have a gun does, or even if it's not germane or on point to this particular issue, it's going to be mentioned in stories. It's going to be dredged up. This is one of those tests you can only fail. You can't win. So to me, politically, I think this was I don't think this was not the way I would have advised him.
I think it's a lose-lose-lose because the governor, didn't have a politically great way to navigate this other than signing it, but it's a lose-lose-lose because Hoosiers are going to be less safe because of this bill. Law enforcement didn't want it. A lot of Hoosier citizens didn't want it. We hear at the start of the session, we hear Republicans say, we're so worried about crime. We're so worried that people aren't supporting our law enforcement. And then what ends up by the end of session, we have this bill that law enforcement says, this makes it harder for us to charge and prosecute violent crime. This makes it harder for us to do our job. And not to mention, we deny thousands of these permits a year for people who should not be carrying. So Hoosiers will be less safe because of what has happened.
Nikki talked about, what does this do for Holcomb running potentially for something in the future? I mean, I could see a campaign ad in which Holcomb is signing this bill and you have Doug Carter saying, you do not support your frontline police officer. Because that's exactly what Doug Carter said. How does that working relationship work?
I don't know. It's hard to explain. I mean, the credibility, the problem Doug Carter has now, not that he'll need it necessarily, but you know, on the third floor of the State House in the legislature, he's got very little credibility to show up and hit that hard, and not have the governor have his back. That's a huge problem. It's no different than, you know, the governor saying he's opposed to Medicaid expansion and the head of FSSA shows up to support it, or Department of Transportation opposes a gas
and
tax.
And what's notable, the governor supports. I think you really don't ever see that happen, which makes this, I think,
right. So, that's why it's so notable for people that are in that building every day. So it's a hard thing to understand how to navigate administratively.
All right. Well, Indiana has, this is just more good news. Indiana has the most polluted rivers and streams of any state. That's according to a new report by the Environmental Integrity Project. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel says it shows that after 50 years of the Clean Water Act, we still have a long way to go to protect our waterways.
Indiana has the most miles of rivers and streams that are deemed too polluted to swim in. Eric Schaefer is the executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project. He says the main culprit is the manure running off of large animal farms called concentrated animal feeding operations, a type of pollution the Clean Water Act wasn't designed to handle.
The law is oriented toward dealing with discharges that come out of pipes that you can see and measure. And that's not typically what you get.
Though there are many large livestock farmers in the state, most of the animals are raised under a contract for just a few major companies, like Tyson and JBS. Schaefer says those corporations should be held responsible for the problem and regulated like any other industry.
John Schwannis, obviously Indiana has a worse problem than other states, but is this a state problem or a federal one?
Yes. It is. It's both. I mean, this is a problem. It doesn't do us any good to point fingers and say this really should be policed at the federal level or this should be policed at the state level, because it doesn't matter what side of the debate you're on. You're still drinking the water or breathing the air that is polluted and may be detrimental, in all likelihood is detrimental to your health. So, we've seen the debate over, we saw it this session with environmental regulation, things shouldn't be at the state level more stringent perhaps than the federal, or local shouldn't be more, county shouldn't be more stringent than state. It's just always this push to sort of back it up to the lowest possible level of enforcement. So there's a lot of blame to go around. And let's keep in mind that most of the fund, aside from enforcement and most of the money that goes into cleanup, that's not state money.
No.
It may be distributed by the state, but that's federal dollars. Yeah. So there's blame and opportunity, I suppose, for both groups to try to do something about these problems.
Realistically, though, do you expect the state and more specifically the General Assembly to listen to that and care?
I mean, there are probably some that care, but most of them are definitely, you know, we've seen over the years, whenever anything on, for instance, confined feeding operations come up, I mean, they always defend the business's right to be there and obviously provide, and let's be fair, they are providing food for all of us and things like that. So they seem fine with the way it is now, don't want to shut down any.
I want to ask about the business side of this, though, too, because the Indiana Chamber's been talking a lot the last few years about water and availability because it's a business issue in terms of the future. When we talk about quality of place, which is the buzz phrase in economic development, that doesn't do much for quality of place, does it?
No, it doesn't, because what's the use of a riverfront or a waterway if you can't build any type of recreation around it? If you have this waterway and what you know about it is, oh, don't go near it, don't touch it. I mean, and to your point about like the legislature, this is the same body that deregulated our wetlands 2 years ago. I just don't think that there is high regard for the waterways, even though we should. Again, you know, there is conversation from the chamber. We are woeful in our statistics, and I think we need to, like John said, everybody has a responsibility. We need to take it seriously, not kick the can down the road.
When does this become? We can't get them to care about environmental issues. When does it become an economic development issue, or is it already?
Well, I think the biggest contributor to this that the study and IDEM recognizes is sewer overflow. And that's been a huge problem for decades in Indiana, and they've spent $6 billion. It's a local responsibility that the locals have no money for, which is why the state is, in the last 15 years, spent $6 billion on it. You know, the study, the ranking requires a little more explanation in that every state sets its own standard of what they want their water used for. Here, is it fishable and swimmable? And then you set your standards on, in order to achieve that goal, and every state does that differently. So it's a little nuanced in terms of, like, no two states are necessarily the same in terms of what they're actually trying to accomplish
with
the quality of
their
water.
Indiana,
it's
regardless.
Not good news for the water. I think they know there's still a lot of work to
and
do.
We know that water in one state never ends up in another state. I mean, clearly it just cleans up when it crosses.
Maybe it's Michigan's problem. We're just south of them.
Build a wall, I say. Right. All right. Finally, the Colts have a new starting quarterback. After jettisoning Carson Wentz, Indy acquired longtime Falcons QB Matt Ryan this week. Mike O'Brien, should Colts fans be excited?
I'm excited about it because I've gotten a lot of Matt Ryan lookalike photos
you
from my
like
friends.
Him.
Like Matt Ryan. Oh.
But also, as a Bears fan, I've loved so much seeing the list of starting quarterbacks for the Colts the last
starting
several
look
years.
Like our
welcome to
was.
Chicago yeah. Bears fan.
He does have a suit Chicago look Bears about him.
Yeah, he does have a suit look with pink shorts. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.